Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor here with Stone Payton, another episode of Atlanta Business Radio. And Stone got a full house today.
A great segment. And the last show that we're going to do from this particular space, because we're going to be moving this week down the hall, same floor, but in some really cool space. So we'll update you on that in the coming weeks. But this is going to be a lot of fun. First up on Atlanta Business Radio this morning, please join me in welcoming to the broadcast life and leadership coach with Arise Coaching, Miss Connie Jones. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me here. Glad to be here.
Well, Connie, can you share a little bit about Arise Coaching? How are you serving folks?
Yeah, well, it's actually Arise Counseling and Coaching. And we're in
counseling.
Yes.
That sounds
I know. Nobody wants to include that part.
Now you're just an intervention.
No. We're all good. I won't pull any of that magic on you today. But I am a psychotherapist by education and did that for 10 years. And then found that I started getting a lot of executives and entrepreneurs come in and leaders of organizations who would come in for counseling with issues in their lives and their relationships. And then I started helping them with business and being an entrepreneur and a former salesperson myself in corporate America. I have giftings for that, and I'm a natural leader. So started having those people come to me, and we started talking about, okay, how can we develop you professionally? How can we develop your organization so that they can be healthy as possible and most effective and most profitable? And so it kind of switched over. I still run own a counseling practice with the counseling and coaching, and there's six of us. And so we have six therapists and coaches who do all kinds of different work with pretty much individuals, families, and groups.
So how do you kind of ascertain which is the right path for someone? Or do they start out as counseling and then they move to coaching, or they start out as coaching, move to counseling?
Yeah,
how does it go back and forth?
Both. Usually when, the counseling is all about understanding your past and healing emotional wounds and healing painful experiences. So when someone is looking for counseling, it usually comes first because it's kind of like think of it like this. It's kind of like a ball of yarn. And so in counseling, you're undoing the ball of yarn, and coaching, you're knitting the sweater. So coaching, you're moving forward. You're creating what you want to create. You're designing your life. You're designing your business. You're growing and developing an organization or your people. Counseling is healing and sorting out.
So now, do you think that most people need to go backwards, or can most people just, kind of be where they're at and then just move forward and just kind of manage the past?
That's what's so cool about being both. Honestly, as a counselor and a coach, I can take people wherever they need to go. Some people need to go back because it's those emotional wounds. It's the lies that we believe about ourselves and about what we can have in our life and about the things that the fear, the insecurities, the things that hinder us in walking in the fullness of who we are every day, and being able to really understand, the world tells us so many things about who we are that is not necessarily who we are.
And so, isn't that the truth?
So I help people pull all of those lies out and help them stand in the fullness of who they are and walk that out every day, because instead of living in the bondage of those negative, ineffective patterns of behavior, ineffective patterns of thinking, I help people really understand what their gifts are, what their strengths are, what they were put here to do, what their purpose is and their passion in life and in their work, and then begin to unleash that full potential instead of being hindered by those things that hold them back and keep them stuck or keep them playing smaller, I call it.
Can you share a little bit about what kind of that first experience is for somebody who gets on your radar? They decide to meet with you or talk to you. What does that first conversation look like, just to give the listener an idea of what they would expect, when they do talk?
That's actually a great question. I usually it's really
do it to Stone.
Yes. So
fix Stone.
Okay, Stone. Are you ready for this?
I'm ready.
Okay. So tell me what brings you here today. Tell me how what's not working in your life is what I usually ask. Where you are today and the gap what is in the gap from where you are today and where you want to be? Tell me what is not working and what you want moving forward.
So what is not working that I'm painfully aware of is the speed. It all seems to be coming together, just not nearly as quickly
right.
as I want it to, or I believe anybody on our leadership wants it to. It's just moving too slow.
Yes. And so you want something more quickly than it's happening. And what does that create for you in that gap? What are the feelings there and the struggles that you have in that?
So for me, it creates frustration. For my wife, she has to listen to me, you know, not be happy out on the deck at the end of the day when
right.
we're having a cocktail. Yeah.
Yes. And so I hear that a lot with people that, you know, it's actually what they want and where they are is what creates the stress for them. And so, and oftentimes that's even, it's perspective that we have to shift in perspective, but oftentimes, and I'm not helping you because I don't go right there with people. Mm-hmm. I really feel them out and really understand where they're coming from, what's not working, what is not like they want it to be. And how do we, and what is that creating for them in their lives? And it affects their relationships. It affects their health. It affects their, you know, the way that they, the things that they do every day and their fulfillment in their life. It affects their thinking. And so it, you know, all of the areas. And so we talk about, okay, you know, what is actually happening? And then how do we move forward? What is it that, you know, what's keeping you stuck? Is it perspective? Is it fear about something? Is it?
I was going to say know. Lee.
Lee,
that's come on, probably, Lee. That's probably
Lee's
not
the
very
problem.
Helpful.
Lee, it sounds like Lee is the one that may need coaching.
Exactly.
Because Lee,
I need counseling. He needs
stuck.
Coaching.
Well, I'll tell you what. What is?
I don't want to pull. I'm trying to be graceful in this because I don't want to, or gracious in this because I don't want to pull out all your. You know, I don't want to make you share too much.
Well, so. Let's talk about the typical. Business person, when they come in in to start talking to you, are there common threads you see that business people or entrepreneurs have?
Yes. A couple of things. Well, I also do, let me start with the executives because I have both. So
when you say executive, that's somebody in a more corporate role as opposed to an entrepreneur
correct.
Is more like solopreneur or somebody
right,
doing their own
right.
thing.
Right. And I do both. What I see with executives is they're frustrated, they're overwhelmed, and they may be incredibly successful. They're making the money. They're at the top of their game. They've achieved, you know, a lot of times where they want to go, but they're not happy. I see the national sales managers who are, you know, traveling all the time, and they feel like the ATM and their family. They, you know, they're tired of the travel, but they feel stuck. They don't know what else to do.
Is it because they don't, or maybe they define success inappropriately or incorrectly?
A lot of times, because the world teaches us that the higher you go.
You blame the world a lot.
Well, I do, you know, I do. And the world is a beautiful place. The world is a wonderful place. But, you know, I mean, there are pressures, there are struggles, there are, you know, that whole performance and achievement thing, which is my background, you know, which has served me well in so many ways. You know, performance and achievement do serve us well to a certain degree, but a certain amount of that, you know, and fulfillment, it's like our, we start selling our soul at some level, and fulfillment in life and, in our relationships and our, you know, the things that our passion and our purpose kind of starts to, wane, and we lose ourselves oftentimes. And then our work becomes our life. And I mean, that can be a wonderful thing when you love what you do. And, you know, I know that we are, you know, we're created to use our gifts and put our passion out in the world and make an influence and make an impact. But too much of a good thing cannot be a good thing
right.
at some points. So
now when you're working as a counselor and you're looking at the past, you're listening and kind of guiding,
right?
Right? But as a coach, are you giving them more kind of stuff to do? It's more practical and more
it is a lot practical.
Do these, you know, I want you to make the 5 calls this morning.
Yes.
Right.
Absolutely.
Where it's more directive, I would think.
It is more directive. I'm a little stronger. As a therapist, I've always been kind of a coach anyway. It's just natural. I've never been one of those, reflective listening therapists. It's always been, I don't ever give people advice or tell them what to do. I help people tap into that inner compass within. You know, we have everything we need inside of us, the wisdom that we need. We know our path. We have our intuition, but most people shut that off because they have to just perform. And so I help people tap back into that so that I don't have, and you know, and what you were asking me a few minutes ago, I'll tie these two in because I never finished about the entrepreneurs. What I see most in entrepreneurs is there are so many business strategies and formulas out there. And so we get lost in, even me, and I struggled with this too early on, you know, what's the right thing to do? And how do I get to the success? How do I get to the success that I want? How do I make that happen? Well, what I help people do is I help them tap into what's inside and help them understand that that I have a seed inside of me, that's the thing that I'm bringing out into the world. That's the thing that I want to make an impact in. And that's the thing that I want to, bring my passion into the world and share that with other people and light other people on fire. That's the fire in our soul. And so oftentimes people have lost that, or they're not clear about the path to bring that out. They're not clear about how to brand themselves. They're struggling with where to spend their time and their energy. And oftentimes there's so many things to do that they don't know what to do.
Right, they get paralyzed by the choice.
Exactly. And so I help people really tap in and hear, what is that path for me and where I'm headed, and what is the timing and what does the flow feel like of that, rather than forcing it.
Now, do you find that a lot of people kind of had this passion and this belief in themselves at a young age, and then just the world, I guess you use that phrase, or just society, their family, just people, saboteurs, kind of chipped away at it to where they lost that kind of core belief in their talent, maybe in certain areas, and they've kind of pushed it down. Then now they're on a path that seemed like the right logical thing, and it maybe made math sense and money sense, but it really isn't lighting them on fire.
Exactly. I literally had a guy who just was he was the top candidate financial advisor for the Southeast, and he's just lighting it on fire. I mean, he's just incredible, so talented, so successful. And he sat in my office last week and he said, you know, all I want to do is have meaningful conversations with men every day and help make their lives better. And I'm having to go hour after hour after hour to make the money to, and it's constant rejection. And it's, you know, and he's at the top of his game and he's miserable. And, right. And so it's like, we think that we have to do something that we don't want to do in order to be successful, that we have those have to's and the can'ts, when really we can say the I wills and the I do's and I can'ts. And that's what I help people do. I help empower people that way.
And then when that light bulb goes off and you see something clearly for the first time in many years, it's hard to unsee that, right?
Yes. Oh my gosh, yes.
So yeah, once you're
it's like that, the ignorance is bliss. And then once you're enlightened, oh my gosh.
It's hard to go back. And then now you're every awakened. Day you're doing this other thing that you are like, that's not really what I should be doing. That probably stresses you out even more. And now you feel like my life could have meaning and I'm personally choosing not to.
Right.
So now you need your help even more, right?
That's at that exactly. point. Yeah. And you
now
know,
that's probably where the coach part comes in and gives you some strategies to get yourself kind of on the right path.
It does. And you know, and oftentimes that feels really overwhelming. And you know, it's like, we don't even want to start that work because, well, I don't want to find out anything, so I have to change anything because this is working well for me. But you know, is it working that well?
Right.
And the thing is I'm not trying to blow up people's lives and you know, I'm here to help. I'm here to guide gently if we need to go that way in order to find that path. You know, you don't just like get on another path all of a sudden. You take little tiny different turns and you see things differently. And when your eyes are open, then, you know, the thing is your heart comes back alive. And then even if you don't change your path, you change your perspective in the things that you're already doing, and life gets better anyway, even if you don't change a whole lot, you know? And so,
well, I can tell you this with one question that was merely an example, I can already feel how it's just helpful to say out loud what's going on in your head. So I find that very I don't know, therapeutic, helpful, just to be able to have someone that you can share that with.
Yes.
The other thing that occurred to me, even in that brief exchange, you don't have to be an expert in the radio business to help me accomplish what I'm trying to to accomplish. And I think, I don't know, maybe that's just me, but I wonder if that's not a myth that some execs and entrepreneurs walk into a conversation like this with, thinking, well, you know, how's this person going to help me? They don't know the first thing about the financial services business or radio or whatever.
That is a great point. And, you know, it really is a gift. And I say that with all, you know, humility. And I mean, it's a gift to be able to see. What I do is I'm an intuitive. So I see things in people that they can't see for themselves. And so I help them find their truth. I help them find their answers inside. So they're the expert. Not me. I just am their guide. I'm their, I help them find that wisdom inside. And then I know, you know, a lot about businesses, and I've had a lot of experiences and come in contact with a lot of different people that just have a knack for gifts for helping people find that for themselves.
So, now, when they work with you, what is the typical length of an engagement? Is this something like, you know, I'm got to do this for the rest of my life, or is this something that I got to see you every day and I'm on the couch, or like, what is the...
Yeah, no. My job is to empower you to be able to do this yourself. So I tell people all the time, you know, if you're in my office years from now, then I'm not doing my job. So even as a therapist, you know, I mean, there's some people that need ongoing, you know, support, but those aren't the clients that I see. I see clients that are very highly functioning and intelligent and just brilliant, gifted. And so, no, they come in, it's 6 months to a year and they're in and out. And, you know, and then it's on to the next thing. Okay. For instance, 6 months in, we've got, you know, your personal and your professional development for you, pretty much solidified, and you're, you know, you're feeling like empowered and ready to go. But then, okay, we start to work on your staff or your organizational right. development or your
because
organizational
health. Because
you
want other people to benefit.
Exactly. Yes. Or, you know, then they may want to, you know, maybe they're working on something, working on one piece in their career, but then, okay, I want to go to the next level. What's next for me? What's that next chapter for me? And so people choose to stay oftentimes because they want to keep, you know, continue to grow and develop. And so we all need that. And then other people just, you know, after they finish their program per se, they just check in and, you know, I'm here for, if they need to have a conversation like, hey, I'm stuck in this one place in my life, or it's a tough time for me. And, I need some wisdom and guidance in that.
So. Now tell us a little bit about your motivational speaking practice.
Yeah. My motivational speaking practice is all of the stuff that I teach every day. And I'm headed more in that direction.
So you're doing that more for organizations and associations and groups
for organizations, right. And groups. I do a lot of, you know, things for women in business, and then just general organizations.
Is that your ideal client, the woman business person?
That is, I have a passion for that. But, you know, I really, believe it or not, work really well with men. My dad was a college football coach. So, and I've been in corporate America. And so I grew up an athlete, and I just kind of, I'm not a, I mean, I'm a savvy businesswoman. I'm a guy's girl. And so I really get men. In as much as a woman can get men. So I enjoy just as much, you know, a lot of people say, you should just empower women. You know, I love empowering women, but I really like empowering men, because men, in our society are, they're some of the ones that have to shut down their soul the most and just do, and, you know, and forget who they are. And, so I really enjoy that work. So no, I do, you know, corporations, organizations, I'll do some leadership development, team development things for those, for bigger organizations and then small businesses. So
on the speaking, do you find yourself, it sounds like you've been doing it a while now, but at least in the early going, was that kind of nerve wracking getting in front of a whole bunch of people and just,
you know,
talking?
It's overwhelming when you don't. I guess the thing that changed it for me is this stuff just flows out of me and I can't not do it. And so when I feel like the things that I've learned in my own life and the things that I get to teach people every day and the things that I see and the situations that I see change and the circumstances that shift in people's lives every day, how do you not share that? And so I have such passion for that. And I sometimes it's hard to keep to keep that to myself.
So the typical fears,
I really don't have those. I mean, I can't say that I don't get nervous a little bit, or
sure,
you know, wonder what are people going to think, or you know, do they want to hear what I have to say? But I don't, you know, and then I just don't really care, because I see so many people that I help who need what is going on in that room with me every day, and not just with me, but in other rooms with other people doing this work. This work is so powerful. And when you see that, you just have to share it.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
So from a business model standpoint, a marketing, sales and marketing standpoint, for you and your practice, does the speaking work feed the counseling and consulting work, and the counseling and consulting work feed the speaking? They feed each other, right?
They really do. They work so hand in hand. And, you know, oftentimes it's really hard to do both, because, you know, when you have clients 4 or 5 a day, and then you're having to go home at night and you're preparing a talk or a, you know, this to be on this podcast or to be on, you know, it's a lot. And I also write weekly inspirations and blog.
Of course you do.
So it's, you know, wow. I mean, all of us, you know, it's multitasking constantly. And so it's really, that's where that, I have a program that I with help people with priority scheduling, and, you know, scheduling in the things that, you know, that you have to do in order, because I have to be fully present everywhere I go. And so I don't need to be thinking about when I'm with a client, I don't need to be thinking about that speech I'm writing. I need to be thinking about the client. And so that helps me a lot to be able to just try to stay present with where I am at the moment.
Well, I would imagine with that kind of schedule, you have to be kind of selective in working with the type of folks you want to work with. Have you identified, look, these are the types of folks or organizations I want to work with? Is there like a sweet spot?
Well, I love corporate America, because that's my background. I really like people with, or organizations with good, with healthy, with good culture, people with good hearts. And I know that's, you know, our business world doesn't want to hear that a whole lot, but, I am a heart-centered, intuitive, business person. And, because of all the things that I've said, up to this point today, that, you know, I believe the heart is central and it drives us. And if we don't understand our own heart and our own soul, then we can't bring out in our fullness what we're meant to bring out into the world and how we're meant to impact. And so I don't really enjoy working with, I'll just say this, I don't really enjoy working with organizations or groups that don't want to hear that. Because I think that's the lifeblood of what we do. But there are tons of organizations who do like that, and they want the passion. They want people to come alive. They want people to awaken. They're all about professional and personal development. And, you know, that's the kind of, and those are the kinds of environments that I love.
Well, speaking of heart, I wanted to ask, because I think I saw this in the bio that I was reading. What's this, a heart sparks? Your heart sparks?
Yes, my heart sparks.
Talk about that before we wrap.
Yeah, those are the weekly inspiration that I write every week. And I do a video along with them. So they're a vlog, video blog. And they're just, I kind of shine the light of truth on things in the way that I see it. For people to awaken their hearts, to ignite that fire in their soul, to help them see things differently, to give them a different perspective on life, a different perspective on their day, a different perspective on their business, and really, you know, help them develop personally and professionally with the things that I write.
So all right. So if our listeners want to reach out and have a conversation with you or tap into these heart sparks, what's the best way? Email, website, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Our website is Arise, A-R-I-S-E, arisecounselingandcoaching.com. And then my email is Connie, C-O-N-N-I-E, J, Connie J, at arisecounselingandcoaching.com.
Well, thank you so much for coming and hanging out with us this morning. This has been a lot of fun and informative, even with my very brief counseling coaching.
Well, I expect better performance now.
I know. We'll have to meet for a little an hour after this.
I'll go back and listen when we get this published on the Business Radio X Network. But I think where we landed was that Lee is the problem.
I take full responsibility for everyone's actions here in this room.
You're the problem and you need the help.
We all learned that today.
Hey, stay with us a little while if you will. Okay?
Oh, I'd love to. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks. All right. Next up on Atlanta Business Radio this morning, we have with us managing partner with Film Hub ATL. Please join me in welcoming to the show, Mr. Herman Garner. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. Good morning.
What'd you learn in that last segment?
That I need to see her. All right. She's probably too expensive for me. Sounds like, but I definitely need to see
Happy
her.
To help. That's what we do here. We make we connect folks. Yeah. So tell us a little bit about Film Hub. Is it Film Hub ATL, Film Hub Atlanta, or interchangeable? How do you say it?
It could be Film Hub ATL or Film Hub Atlanta, but the website is filmhubatl.com.
All right. So mission, purpose, what are you guys out there doing for folks?
Well, we initially started out just doing some networking. We wanted to bring the Atlanta film community together, give some of the independent filmmakers an opportunity to connect. You know, social media is a fantastic thing. You meet people on social media, LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, you know, and then Kick and, you know, this some of the newer platforms. But the face-to-face is still, in my mind, the most important connection.
That's where the magic happens, right?
That's where the magic happens. You can look at someone, you can smell their breath.
and you had me right up
and kind of get a feel for who they are. And that's where the real connections get made. And so we do have a platform on the website where people can kind of interact, like Facebook. But those face-to-face connections are...
So that's what you create events for the community.
Right.
So you have one coming up?
Exactly. And so the first event we did, which was just a couple months ago in October, we had 350 people come out.
Mm-hmm.
We catered the food and had the beer and wine. And then the second event we had, we actually had about 1,500 people come
out.
And that was just a couple months later.
So people are hungry for this.
People, there is a tremendous surge of energy around film in the Atlanta film mm-hmm. community. And so, you know, people just came out. And in fact, there were actually more than 1,500 people who wanted to come, but the capacity of the building wouldn't accommodate them. And so...
Bigger and better, right?
Bigger and better. And so for this event, it is March 5th at the Georgia International Convention Center. And
that should hold them. That's a big venue.
That should hold them. So we're anticipating about 3,500 film people coming out. Now, the demographics of that group is at least from our experience, is about 60% people who are actually involved in film.
Mm-hmm.
Those are producers, camera people, casting agents, script writers, people who actually produce, all the way down to or up to or laterally to the porta potty people. And so I didn't want to say
vendors.
Down to. Exactly, right. Just people who service the film community. And then we have about 20% music people, people who score films, but also just people who are involved in music. And then about 20% actors and models. And so that's pretty much the makeup of the people coming out.
Now, can you educate the audience a little bit about the size of the film world here in Georgia? Because I guess a lot of this was spurred from that tax credit that came about a few years ago.
Exactly.
And now we're getting to the point where this state is one of the largest kind of producers of film and television.
Right.
In the world, probably at this point.
It has been declared the largest film producing state in at least the United States. I'm not sure about the world. But what's interesting is that, you know, sometimes number one and number two can be a million and then number two may be 100,000.
Right.
So it's hard to say. But just the trajectory that it's currently on, it's going to continually increase every year. And so what our concern was about the independent filmmakers is that a lot of the money, the $9 billion...
is that what it is about?
About...
$9 billion a year?
In 2017.
Yeah. In 2017, $9 billion.
$9 billion. And that's a lot of
money.
Starts
adding up to real money.
But the issue that we were kind of trying to confront was the fact that many of the local Atlanta film people were not actually able to take advantage of
that. So they
that.
Get kind of lost in the, you know,
lost.
When the Marvel movies are here, they're just sucking up all the oxygen. And
right.
The independent person that's just got a vision and wants to make a documentary about, you know, pottery, they're kind of no one's paying attention to them.
And then there really is some good content that's springing up in the Atlanta film community. And a lot of that money is made with the major studios.
Right.
And so they import people or transport people in.
So they come in, they do the gig, and then they leave. So they're not really part of the Georgia community, but they're using the Georgia resources.
Exactly. And so we wanted to make sure that the local independent filmmakers had an opportunity to connect and to identify some resources, internal resources. And a lot of times what the smaller filmmakers lack is a team, you know, because you can only be so, and then also the financial resources.
So, how did you get involved in this? Are you a filmmaker?
You know what? I'm not a filmmaker. I originally moved to Atlanta a couple years ago. I was involved in supply chain consulting, helping small businesses.
We do a show on supply chain.
Okay. But just helping small businesses interface with the supply chains of large organizations. I went to a meetup. Are you guys familiar with meetup?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so I went to a meetup for film and saw
but
how...
But just because you were interested or you like to watch movies, like...
Well, I just saw the amount of energy around film, and I said, you know what? I could the skills that I use with the small businesses are immediately transferable into, because it's basically, you know, just bringing people
it's
together.
It's logistics, right?
It's logistics, right? And so the distribution is the one of the key components to, because no one will finance a film or even work on it unless you have a distribution model kind of already on the horizon. And so we kind of help with helping the small filmmakers develop that distribution model that works for their film.
Now, is it just you or you have a team?
It's me and my core team is Teron Somerville and Samuel Winley. These are some people I work with on a daily basis. And then we have several other people who are loosely connected that handle like marketing and graphic design and website development, that kind of stuff.
But the core is this website. And then from that are these... events that you're doing now every couple months or so?
Well, you know what? This event that we're having now, and one of the things we try to do is we give people an opportunity to network together.
Right.
But we're also trying to network and build a relationship with the local film community.
Sure.
And so our goal is not just to network. Our goal is to introduce ourselves, become friends with the Atlanta community, film community. And then ultimately what we would like to do and in the latter part of 2018 is give the largest film festival in the state of Georgia. And the reason why we want to do that is because we want, there are already silos, you know, Hollywood, Los Angeles, New York, Chicago, they're all notorious or infamous for cliques.
Right.
And so if you aren't in the clique, you can't, you can't introduce your material.
Sure.
And so we want, and Atlanta's already building those cliques. We want to create an environment where there are no cliques. Mm-hmm. And you're just recognized for your talent. And so we want like everybody to submit their films. We don't care, you know, like for instance, there are like Black film festivals, Jewish film festivals. And that shouldn't even be a consideration if your work is good work.
It should just be a film festival.
Exactly. And so we want to just dispense with that mentality. And we just want to have one universal film festival.
Well, you know, my vision that you can help me with is to build Georgia or Atlanta-based South by Southwest type festival and tap into the music and the film, the gaming. We have a lot of kind of creative people doing good work here, and it takes a logistics genius like yourself to kind of think outside of film and bigger, and then make a South by Southwest experience here in Georgia.
Okay, absolutely.
Can work on that?
Absolutely.
South by Southeast.
Southeast by Southeast. So what do you think?
You know what?
I'll let you build your film one first, but that's just down the road.
Yeah.
We're going to piggyback.
Future Herman can work on this one.
Okay. Okay. And so, you know, one of the things we also recognize is that, you know, because, we're, you know, so the film festival is really to just get a better understanding of the kind of content that's being developed and identify the players who have really good content and have the ability to deliver on that. Right. Mm-hmm. But then we also recognize that, you know, the whole industry is turned on its head with this VOD, video on demand and streaming.
Right.
And so, you know, you have like the content wars, like Netflix has already declared that they're going to spend $8 billion in 1 year on the development of film. And of course, Hulu, Crackle, Amazon, even Facebook, YouTube, everyone's pretty desperate to, because the distribution channel used to be the barrier to entry. It was the distribute, but now that isn't the case. For around 100,000, you can build a platform that competes with Netflix in terms of the number of users who can actually utilize that site at the same time.
Right.
And so if because that barrier doesn't exist, everyone's competing for content. And so we would like to categorize or catalog all the content, and then at some point be able to sit across from the table from the major players and offer content to them because they need it.
Now, when you're helping them with this content creation, are you finding that there's, can you share maybe a story where you helped a young filmmaker, a new person kind of get going and get a deal or kind of have their idea?
So we've been in business for only a couple months. And
have you kind of scouted? You got your eye on some talented people?
We do have our eye on some talented people. We haven't done it yet, though. Mm-hmm. And so I guess it might be the theoretical at this point. But I'm an entrepreneur. But what we have done is we've watched probably about 100 films, 100 successful films. And so we've identified some of the components of a successful film on a VOD platform.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we recognize is that, and I'm sure everyone's here has used Netflix or Amazon or something like that, right? Yeah. And so the old model was you paid, you know, $10 to get into the theater. You watched a movie. If it didn't develop in the first couple of minutes, you had $10 invested. So you gave it maybe 10 or 15 minutes before you did. I've even walked out of some movies mm-hmm. that were terrible, right? But you gave it time to develop. But well, on a VOD platform, you know, you pay your monthly subscription. If something doesn't spark an interest in the first couple minutes, then you're off to the next thing because you don't have anything invested.
Right.
And so one of the things we've created is this model for different genres of movies. And if you brought a movie or a script, we would say, well, you know what? This is a great script, except there's no care moment. The care moment doesn't happen early enough. And it's not going to be, it won't be successful on the VOD platform
mm-hmm.
Because people will just switch off and they're not going to give you an opportunity to develop characters. You need to do something, create that care moment earlier in the film. And then we look at the number of obstacles, for instance, that the protagonist has to overcome before the movie climaxes. Because what we found is that, and we've looked at different films, right? Like for instance, maybe in the 80s and the 90s when videos first came out, right? There were like maybe 30 scenes in a 3 or 4 minute video. But then MTV came along and they said, well, we can compress 60 or 70 scenes in a 3 minute video.
Right.
And so they realized that people had the ability to assimilate more information, much more than they thought, and people still enjoyed it. And so the newer films, the films that are successful, they can't just be that linear, you know, just protagonist overcome obstacle. They have to have like a tree of things going on. Because modern viewers are accustomed to assimilating a lot of information. And so the protagonist might go through a divorce. He might have an accident. He might have a daughter who has some issues. And all these things get resolved. But they're just like subplots. And so we look at those films to ensure. And what it does is it means that the writer has to be a lot smarter in his writing to create something that people can follow, right? So, you know, and sometimes we've even seen movies. If you can predict the movie, while you know that is probably not a good movie, you can predict it because that means that the writer wasn't really that sharp, or you're just super intelligent, one or the other. I don't know, but and so we created this model, and so when you come with that with a genre of a film, we just plug it into the model and see whether or not it meets the minimum criteria for a chance of success. It doesn't mean it's going to be successful,
right?
But we're going to use that platform to produce or to identify the movies that we think would have the best chance on the new platforms that are out there, which is the VOD and the streaming. And that's the wave of the future.
So now you can, do you have resources that can help somebody that has a screenplay get it to Netflix where it's bid on, where they can say, we want to produce this?
Well, we're just beginning now to reach out to our contacts at Netflix and kind of introduce ourselves, but we haven't solidified any working relationships with them. But they we are on their radar, and they do recognize, you know, one of the things that they recognize is that we got 3,500 people coming out
right to events
to an event, and 3,500 people. Of course, that's not like a lot of people, but in one industry, And then we haven't even done any really serious marketing.
Right.
We've primarily been using a social media and word of mouth. And people are just so excited about film. And you know, people have moved here from all over the country and the world to pursue a career in film. And so there's a tremendous amount of energy in that.
Now, walk us through what's going to happen at this event. So you go to the event, and what is it, in the beginning of March?
It's March 5th. It's an interesting thing. We don't really have a big like a presentation or something like that. We don't have panels. We don't think that panels really facilitate or increase people's networking. You just watch a panel, you get some information, but you haven't met anyone, right? Mm-hmm. And that's the typical.
So the emphasis is on meeting as many people as possible or connecting with different groups of people.
And so we encourage everyone to bring business cards and marketing material. You know, and if you literally just sat down and passed out material, we would encourage that as opposed to discourage it. We want people to connect. But we got some interesting things going on. We got 40 feet of games, carnival-like games, along one wall, mm-hmm. like the basketball and the
ski ball.
The ski ball, that's what it's called, ski ball, right? The ski ball and some other games. And these are meant to encourage people to interact, right? So we got 40 feet. And then we have the horse from The Walking Dead. He'll be there taking pictures. Tommy Turvey.
You got to have celebrities.
Right? And then we have, so we got the 3,500 people moving around the room, right? And then we have two ducks, costume ducks. We have two ducks, one bear, and a chicken costumes.
For photo opportunities.
Photo opportunity, exactly, right? And so we're going to have these people and just kind of moving around and just taking pictures and encouraging people to do what they're there to do is you know, a lot of film people, you know, they're involved in film. This isn't the front end of the film. This is the back end, right?
Right.
And so these are introverts. You know,
you got to work to get them.
Right. Right. And so we have
you're their wingman.
Exactly.
And then, so there's going to be, it sounds like a fun time. And, this is just the beginning though. You're going to start doing these in a rhythm that's,
exactly.
Kind of more predictable every couple months or so, are you looking at?
Well, we're thinking twice a year.
Two times a year.
And then the film festival, which we've already kind of started mapping out. And we already have some sponsors. We're going to try to give away $100,000 and a lot of expensive equipment.
And so like scholarships or for budding filmmakers or just money for them to use?
Prize money.
Wow. Good stuff.
Right.
So now, what do you need from us? How can we help you?
Well, you've already helped. You know, you
well, we believe in helping first. So
okay.
What else can we do for you?
You can come out and do a live broadcast.
He's not afraid to ask. That's good.
I mean, you know, because, we think that, you know, if you support the Atlanta film community, you support Atlanta because this is the fastest
growing
industry.
And if you don't, then you don't support Atlanta. Does it work both ways?
Well, you know what? I mean,
look, Karen's a lawyer here. She's here to watch my back.
Not that kind of lawyer.
No, but really, and because it is the fastest growing industry in Atlanta, and just like Silicon Valley is known for technology, and Cleveland, Ohio, to a certain extent, is known for biotechnology. You know, and different areas are known for different things, right?
Yeah.
Cleveland, Ohio used to be known for steel. It's no longer known for steel. The steel mills.
So we are here to help, and we'd love to talk to you off mic about ways we can help and work together. But if somebody wanted to learn more about what you guys got going on, what's the coordinates for Film Hub ATL?
You know what? It is filmhubatl.com. Filmhubatl.com. And we still have some tickets available, some VIP. It's amazing that the VIP tickets have sold twice as fast as the general admission tickets.
So you need more VIP tickets.
I think people like to be VIPs in Atlanta.
Who doesn't? Who doesn't like to be VIP?
Sure.
Well, I found it an interesting conversation, but to be perfectly candid with you, you had me at beer. So, I mean, we could have been done. Well, keep up the good work, man. This is fantastic.
Thank you.
Hey, stay with us, will you? We got one more guest.
Absolutely.
All right, Lee, you ready for the headliner?
I am.
Okay, please join me in welcoming to the broadcast with Weinstock Immigration Lawyers, the lady herself, managing attorney, Karen Weinstock.
Good morning.
Glad to have you. You've been very patient, and but I suggest that, I don't know, it looked like maybe you were learning a thing or two. You were tapping into the conversation. What did you think about the earlier part of the show?
Well, I do really believe in what Connie's doing, because really having your purpose first and doing things with meaning will have a great effect on your career, happiness, fulfillment. I can tell you that I've been doing that for the last almost 20 years, trying to help people achieve their American dream, come to the country, immigrate, help companies do the same thing. We've also tapped in the film industry. Getting some visas for actors, actresses, producers, really talent from overseas, and trying to keep a positive attitude in this time of heightened scrutiny and really very tough government to deal with immigrants in any form of the of them coming here legally. Actually, the legal immigrants are the ones who are targeted the most, which is ironic.
Right.
Yeah, it is ironic.
Now, can we talk a little bit about, well, first, let's get into how you chose immigration as your specialty. Were you always, was this always the plan, like as a little girl?
No, I knew from a very early age that I wanted to be a lawyer. But I grew up in Israel.
What were the clues?
I grew up in Israel. There's no immigration lawyers in Israel. So that's yeah. It's a different immigration system. If you're Jewish or you know, born to a Jewish descent, you can get citizenship in Israel, no problem. Mm-hmm. Every other nationality or religion, that's going to be a little bit tough. But So I basically went to law school after my military service. And then during law school, I just did not want to practice law in Israel. And I had two opportunities, one to go to the UK, the other one to go to the United States. And one of my mother's relatives really graciously helped me to get to New York. She had a beautiful apartment overseeing the Hudson River. And mm-hmm. she said, come stay with me for a few months, study for the bar exam and see if you can do it. So I said, fine, that sounds great. Let's try. There's nothing to lose. I
so
was
in
young.
Your head, how were you deciding between England and the United States? Were those two like similar in your mind, or was it the apartment over the Hudson? Was the tipping point like?
Yeah, the free housing in New York City.
One country over another.
Yeah, that was just a tipping point. Yeah, so I just, you know, even though London was closer to home right. In Israel, and then I moved here for a few months to study for the bar exam. I did pass, and then kind of went to be sworn in and kind of started to network, and one thing led to another. And I got some connections in New York, and that's where I lived first and worked first. And then I had my own personal struggle with immigration because I couldn't get a visa without a job, and I couldn't get a job without a visa. And right. it was, you know, back in the day, you didn't have debit cards. So like even getting cash out of the ATM,
check, right.
it was really rough. And just, you know, looking over my shoulder if I was going to get robbed or not. And then a lot of struggles. I couldn't get an apartment because I didn't have credit. It was a lot of hoops I had to jump, and I was all alone. I just didn't know what to do. And so I basically started with corporate law for a couple of years and did not like that very much. And then 9/11 happened.
Mm-hmm. And, so you were in New York for that?
Before 9/11, there was a dot-com crash, right. Crash and burn. And when that happened, I kind of thought, well, I don't really like doing corporate law. I was doing a lot of startup technology, stuff like that. I don't really like it. And if I have to read over a 100-page agreement again, I'm going to shoot somebody. So I got in touch with this immigration lawyer who helped me initially with my visa. And he said, well, why don't you come do immigration law? Open an office for us. I'm like, great. Where do I sign up? So 10 days before 9/11, I packed up a U-Haul and drove all the way to Tennessee.
wow.
And then 9/11 happened.
So on 9/1, you were in Tennessee.
Yeah. Yeah, it was surreal.
Because where the Hudson is kind of near where 9/11 was.
Yeah, yeah. It was surreal. Like, I don't know if I would have survived living in New York if I had stayed there.
Wow.
But even for the immigration part, everything stopped. All the visa processing stopped, all the green cards, all the government agencies, like they didn't know what they were doing.
Right. So they just locked everything down.
Yeah. And that was my first experience with immigration law.
So it gave you a chance to kind of acclimate yourself to Tennessee, though.
Yeah, exactly.
So tell us about, so now you're in Tennessee and now you're an immigration attorney. What is that like? Who are your clients and how are you serving them?
So most of my clients are companies who want to retain foreign talent, either bring executives or people in an overseas subsidiary or parent company or some type of related entity, or companies who want to hire talent in the United States. And a lot of them are graduates of universities, of U.S. universities, and a lot of them are in sciences, computer sciences, mathematics, and really smart people, engineering.
Because a lot of smart people in these countries come to the United States universities to study.
Right, right.
Right. Is that still allowed or that's even being curtailed?
It's being curtailed. It's allowed. But the problem is that because the H-1B visa, that's the predominant visa for them to work here after they graduate, that's been cut down and hasn't been increased.
In the number of people allowed to use that visa?
Yeah, it's a fixed number. It's been like that for the last 30 years, and it hasn't been increased. Obviously, there's more demand. There's more people coming.
Right.
Then at the end of it, if they don't get the visa, they have to go get back home. So you come here, you get a great education, you pay $20,000, $25,000 in a public university and $30,000 to $40,000 in a private one. 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, depending on how long your studies are. And then you have to go back home, which is crazy.
Right. So we're investing or we're allowing them to come here. They're taking up space in the university. And then we're saying, thank you. Now go back home and take all that learning you did here and then go back to your home country and then use it. That's the thinking, I guess.
There's no thinking behind politicians. Sorry. There's no thinking whatsoever. And that's really the sad part of it, that people don't realize that, you know, if somebody just got an education, let's say I got a PhD in math or computer science, I have all this knowledge, all those skills. I have plenty of employers who want to hire me because I'm so smart.
Right.
Because let's say I graduated from Georgia Tech or something like that. Well, I don't have a visa to work on, so I have to go back home.
Right. And then, so now your firm helps these people kind of navigate the system, or there's only so much you can do, right, with the law being what it is?
So we're trying to find solutions as much as we can and be a little bit more creative and work with companies who are willing to work with the employees and support them. And sometimes there are solutions and sometimes there's not. And then a lot of times really it's planning in advance. If you know you're going to graduate, you apply for the visa, you know, in advance. Sometimes it depends on what it is. In some cases, you can even apply for a green card faster. You can get a temporary visa, which is crazy. But in some cases, even to get a green card based on employer, for example, if you're from India or China, it might take you 5 to 10 years.
Wow.
And that's legal immigration. It's crazy. You've gone through a lot of hoops and you got all the authorizations, but you're stuck waiting for a visa.
Now, for the people that are going through this, this isn't something you can do by yourself, right? Like you can't just go, I'll just go on the website and then get this done.
No. If you want to get an approval, no.
Right? Because like one mistake can set you back and then you're in kind of this spiral of bureaucracy.
Correct. You basically, the Immigration Service doesn't care. You either do it correctly or you're out of here, basically.
And then that'll add even more time to the process. Or it could mean that you're just completely out and you have to leave the country. A mistake.
So sometimes you have a chance to correct it. Sometimes you don't. So it just depends on how it is. If you file in the wrong category, for example, they won't even let you correct it. If you file, let's say you have a typo or you're missing a document, they'll let you correct it, but you only have one chance.
Mm-hmm. So the stakes are super high. So it's best to have a professional kind of guide you through this.
Yes, and most people are aware of that, and they do hire professionals because it's just, it's too cumbersome.
And complicated. Now, tell us about DACA, DACA. Is that, that's in the news almost every day lately?
Yeah, so DACA is basically a measure, a presidential measure that President Obama just said, I'm sick of Congress not doing anything about immigration for so many years, and I'm going to help those young people who came here into the country, either legally with a visa and stayed, or they just crossed the border with their parents or family members. They arrived to the United States as minors before the age of 16, and they've lived here for over 5 years. So most of them are either grew up here as kids, went to schools here, high schools, college, some served in the military. And so I'm giving them a temporary measure of being able to stay here, not worry about being deported, and giving them work cards. And that was totally within his authority. And then there were a lot of lawsuits from different states trying to cancel it and whatnot. That didn't work.
So this was a federal ruling?
Yeah, it was a federal ruling. And a lot of people actually got and applied for DACA. And then after President Trump was sworn in, he said, no, I don't like it anymore. And it's going to get canceled. And then he changed his mind and said, okay, well, I really like DACA, but I need to Congress to act on it. So I'm going to rescind it anyway to let Congress act on it, which is kind of childish because obviously they're not doing anything. And so now you have a situation where a lot of people are in limbo because you have people who have applied and are expiring or will expire soon. And those are people who are employed right now, most of them having jobs. And you have a lot of employers that are relying on these employees to continue. And so there was an injunction that was issued by a federal court recently that said to the government, you can't rescind it like that. And I'm prohibiting you from rescinding it bilaterally or unilaterally like that. So now the ruling is, okay, you can, the people who had DACA before can renew it. But then the government appealed. So now it's in appeals courts. And I don't know what the appeals courts are going to say, whether they're going right. to uphold the injunction or not.
And you're talking, this is millions of people, right?
Yeah, a few million people. There's at least 600 to 700,000 people that we know of that have the status. A lot of them are elementary school teachers. Again, a lot of people that really were educated in the U.S., they call the U.S. home. They don't have nobody home. Their entire family's here.
Right.
Their only crime was to come with their family when they were young. And it's just silly that they can't get even a permanent status. But DACA is not a permanent status, just a temporary relief. So it's not even
right, so
path to citizenship, which is really what ought to be happening. This is what Congress should do, is give a path to citizenship and legalize all those folks.
And then this is all being negotiated right now.
Right. I don't know what negotiation is, but right now nothing's happening.
Right, so it's still in this kind of unsteady. Nothing is solidified where we're saying this is the rule. It's going back and forth between what the president, Congress, and the courts are all kind of.
Yeah, so basically, the president and the Congress, the politicians, do nothing other than blah blah blah, speak to speak. So they're doing nothing. If you want to help. Then call your congressman, tell them to support DACA. Call your senator, tell them to support DACA. Especially if you're a business owner, you're in business, they need to support it. And then the second part is the court system that they're trying to work with opening the rule back up when the president has shut it down.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a different thing in the legal system. Whether it's constitutional, whether it's not, whether you know you can rescind a program like that without any notice, et cetera, et cetera. And those are legal questions that smarter people than I are arguing it with, district courts, appellate courts, federal courts.
But all these immigration rules, are they federal or are they state? Like what? Who?
All the immigration rules are federal rules. So immigration has always been federal. The issue, for example, why DACA has been halted before was that a few states, including Texas, sued the federal government, said, well, I don't have money to issue driver's licenses to all those people who are going to be eligible for DACA. So I'm not going to give that privilege to people. And
because that's a state, right? Is the driver's license?
The driver's license is a state, but the immigration is federal. So again, lawsuits happen and they say, well, if a person has a legal status like DACA, you have to give them a license. Right. That's how it is. You can't discriminate one versus the other.
Right.
So then there were lawsuits again. And so, yeah, the lawyers are really making a killing on the Trump administration.
And okay, so you talked about, we have DACA as an issue. We talked about the visas for individuals. There's also visas for investors, right? There's, if you're wealthy in another country and you want to invest here, do you get some kind of shortcut, or is there a way to kind of cut the line?
So there's a couple of different options. There's actually EB-5, which is if you invest $1 million or more and create 10 full-time jobs, you can get a green card. And in some areas...
Is there a limit to that, or is that unlimited?
There's a limit of 10,000 a year.
So 10,000 people with $1 million plus get free passes. It's fast pass.
It's not a fast pass. It's actually very slow. And they're actually, yeah. And it's there's actually very better opportunities for somebody who's an entrepreneur and has a business.
Mm-hmm.
But some people don't, and they want to do the EB-5, which is okay. Now it's being debated to jump from $1 million to $1.8 million. And
the amount that you have to invest.
To invest,
in
correct.
In order to get that.
And it's still 10 full-time jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also what's called an entrepreneur rule. Again, President Obama, the administration issued it at his time, which means if you are an entrepreneur without the minimum investment, but if you create a company and you employ a certain number of people, for example, 10 people, then even technology startup, anything like that, obviously it contributes to the economy. It helps create jobs. So we can give you a special permission to stay and work. And that rule is being challenged by the Trump administration, and they said that they're going to eliminate that as well.
And none of these things are paths to citizenship. They're just visas to work for a period of time.
So the EB-5 with the $1 million investment is a path to citizenship. If you do end up investing the $1 million and you do end up creating the 10 full-time jobs, if you don't, sorry, out of luck, you have to go back.
Mm-hmm.
With the other one, the entrepreneurial one, it's just a temporary measure. So it's a temporary visa, temporary ability to work and stay here to create your company. And unfortunately, it doesn't lead to a permanent status. But that even too is being revoked soon. We don't know when. And so really this administration is really anti-business. It's really hurting a lot of people, a lot of businesses, a lot of technology companies, all the companies that need a lot of manufacturing companies that are global, because
mm-hmm.
every company is global. Atlanta has a few global companies, and you'll ask any of the executives, yeah, they move people all over from one country to the
right.
other.
And they need to be able to do that. So now for you and your firm, you specialize in immigration. You're the visa pros.
Yes.
On social media. Can you talk about the organizations that are calling you up right now? Like who's a good prospect for you?
So for us, really, the international companies. So a lot of U.S. subsidiaries or foreign-owned companies.
So a foreign-owned company that has offices here in the United States, it's good to have you in their network to help them navigate some of this?
Yeah, for sure. As well as companies, U.S. companies that have global operations, and then U.S. companies who mostly in technology, engineering, and manufacturing, who hire foreign nationals because they need the skill set.
So you have offices here. Do you have offices overseas as well?
No, nope. Only in Atlanta. And really, we work around where our clients are. So we do Skype calls with our European clients in the morning, and we do it in the afternoon with the Far East clients.
So you have clients now all over the world?
All over the world, yes.
So you're a good immigration success story?
Yes. My firm now is 12 people, all women, by the way. And trying to empower women. And we have a very diverse team, like our clients.
Mm-hmm.
We have like 8 or 9 nationalities.
Wow.
5, 6 languages.
That's great.
So now any story you can share that you're most proud of?
Well, my most proud story is really my team story, because it kind of solidifies all the challenges that our clients go through.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that we're able to kind of work together with all the different culture, all of the different opinions, all the different viewpoints is really something that I'm really proud of. And it makes us such a great team. And it's just, it's incredible. It's incredible. Like we needed, for example, we're looking for a new marketing assistant. And the best person that we found, that was a few years ago, lived in Spain. So we actually brought a person from Spain because she was the best person for the job. And, you know, did a Skype interview and...
Do they live in Spain? That's where they're based? Or they came
here? No, she came here and, you know, now she has a green card and she's fabulous. And really that's some of the things that, you know, I tell my clients, you know, if that's the best person for the job, if that's the best person for you, hire them if you can.
Right.
And so, and that's what we're doing ourselves. So, you know, lead by example.
And then do you find Atlanta, the diversity here in Atlanta is, welcoming? How did you find your time here in Atlanta?
Atlanta has grown a lot in the last 15 years since I've been here. A lot more international people, a lot more people not from Atlanta,
mm-hmm.
Which is very different than the time that I first moved here. A lot of people were from Atlanta.
Right.
So I think Atlanta is really a good hub for people because it does offer a quality of life. And good weather and East Coast time. If you're European, it's great, and you have direct flights to anywhere,
right?
Almost. So it's a good it's really a good opportunity for companies to come here.
And you're finding a lot of people still want to come here, and they're choosing Atlanta as a place that they want to live. Like, is Atlanta on the radar for some of these international people?
Sometimes it is, and sometimes it isn't. I think that Atlanta does do better now in marketing itself to international companies. There's still a way to go because a lot of international companies kind of think about, okay, Miami, New York, Chicago.
Right.
Like they still think about the large hubs and when you say, okay, what not Atlanta? And then you talk about the advantages and all of that, then access to workforce and...
Right.
Then okay. Well, let me think about it. So I think there's still work to do.
Right. It's not top of mind, but once they hear about it, it's pretty persuasive story to choose Atlanta over the other ones.
At least come visit and look at it, and do your market research and everything. But at least you know, come and look at it.
Well, if somebody wanted to learn more and or they're having immigration challenges, what's the website for you guys?
Visa.
So much for being part of the show today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
All right. Thanks to all of our guests today and my co-host, Stone Payton, our producer, Katie Galley. We will see you all next time on Atlanta Business Radio.